G'day guys, welcome back to Dylan Friends. This week on the show, one of the world's most renowned big wave surfers and Australia's own Mark Matthews. Mark has an unbelievable story. He grew up in Maroubra, 10k southeast from Sydney. As many of you would know, Maroubra was made pretty famous back in the early 2000s from the Bra Boys, in which Mark was a massive part of. He spoke about his journey growing up in a pretty tough neighbourhood, pushing the limits in and out of the water, and how he came to surf some of the biggest waves in the world. He talks in depth of a massive moment in his life where he almost died surfing Shipstern's Bluff in Tasmania, which took a massive toll on his health and confidence. The way he got himself back to his best is nothing short of amazing, in which he developed a heap of incredible techniques to challenge your thoughts. I bloody love this chat with Mark, and I'm sure you will too. He's an absolute superstar and cannot thank him enough for coming on the show. If you enjoy this ep and all the others, please don't forget to follow on Spotify and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It really does help a lot. And last but not least, a big, big thank you to Bloke in a Bar for all the love and ongoing support. Get in store and grab yourself a slab to share with your mates. Head to blokeinabar.com to check your nearest stockist. The link will also be in the show notes. Let's go.
My name is Deborah, Dylan's mum. Welcome to the Dylan Friends podcast.
Many ways, I've been waiting my whole life for this moment.
Tears.
Strength.
I'm like, I run. She's like, Everyone runs. I'm like, but does everyone go to the Olympics?
They're sitting there meditating, going, oh my God, I think I'm meditating. How good is this? I'm meditating. It's
like, we had a Wu-Tang call. I was like, yo, Dylan, thanks for getting us in.
Just love
it's
it.
Knuckle puck time.
Yeah.
It's like don't forget to subscribe and leave a review.
Mark Matthews, it's an honour, it's a pleasure, and it's an absolute privilege to have you on Dylan Friends, mate. This has been a long time in the making, and it's an honour to have you on the show.
Mate, I'm stoked to be here.
Yeah, I honestly started this show probably about 3 years ago, and I put down like a bucket list of guests, and I kid you not, you're in my top five people that I...
Come on, mate. You say that to everyone.
Honestly, sure. People would know, I do not say this to everyone. I put you on the list, and it's taken me a long time. The amount of times I've DM'd you on Instagram, shit myself, unsent it, and then waited like months on end just to tee this up. And I thought, you know what, Dil, fuck it. You nearly hit 100 eps. It's time to get the big dog on the show and hear the story, mate. So, in all seriousness.
All your other guests are just listening to this and just going, I can't believe I wasn't in the top five. I'll take it back.
They were just the prequel to what's about to be a fantastic show.
We'll see.
We will. Hey, you are one of the biggest big wave surfers, most renowned big wave surfers in the world. Firstly, how does that even become a thing? When does that happen? How did you start this? When did the dream start?
Oh man, it's a long story. I think if I shaved it down, it would be, I loved surfing growing up, like absolutely loved it. My family surfed, my dad, my mum rode a bodyboard, my sister surfed. So I grew up surfing and I loved it so much. Like every other kid, I wanted it to be my job. And I also hated working equally as much. So it was like, I wanted to make a career out of it, and I wasn't good enough to be a competitive world tour surfer and compete for a world title. And that I kind of came to that realization probably when I was about sort of around 17, like 16, 17. And at that point, I wasn't really renowned big wave surfer. You know, I was usually the more scared kid when I was growing up compared to other surfers or other kids that I was surfing with. So it wasn't a natural thing for me to go, oh, I can be a big wave surfer. But it was more just I was desperate to make a career out of the sport that I loved, that I just pushed myself to surf bigger and bigger waves because that was the road that I could see to where I could get a surfing career, because I wasn't good enough to compete. I could do it if I could surf the waves that no one else wanted to surf. There was a career in that. So it was just like, for me, the learning journey's more been able to deal with fear and overcome that fear so I can push myself to surf those waves.
It's incredible knowing that now, I suppose. You know, I've done so much research. I know I would like to think I know a lot about you. And early in your journey to hear that your mum had to come and save you from out the back of the surf to now becoming, you know, hearing what you're saying now, saying you just wanted to push yourself to surf the biggest waves possible. Like at a time back then, what was holding you back? Like as a young kid growing up in, you know, Eastern Sydney Southeastern Sydney, Maroubra, how does that even transpire, I suppose, to getting to where you are now?
Yeah, what was holding me back? I don't know. It's usually a multiple of factors. Like There has to be some genetic things that are built into you when you're born around risk taking and stuff. And I just don't think I was ever that real risk taking kid. Like that on top of a couple of scary moments in the surf when I was young. Like I have a real clear one when I was probably, I would have been 11 years old of just getting held underwater by a wave that, and it held me down for long enough to be like, oh my God, I'm not going to come back up. And that kind of scarred me. And, and then those different things just made me apprehensive about surfing big waves. I still love surfing, but I didn't necessarily want to go out and surf huge waves. But it was 2001 where I fell in love with surfing big waves, and it was just a multitude of factors that got me there. It was like, at the time I was working down in Circular Quay in a bar making coffees, cocktails. Like my surfing, my dream of being a professional surfer was pretty much fading out. Like it was gone. I was about to go back and look to start studying or what other career path I could take. Like I would have been 19, 20 at the time, like a year out of school. And then I get a call from a guy from Track Surfing magazine, the editor, and he invited me to come on a surf trip for the magazine down to Tasmania. And at that point in time, like I was a no one in surfing. Like I couldn't even believe that the editor of Track Surfing magazine was ringing me. And I was kind of in my head, I was like, well, why is this guy ringing me? And I found out actually down the track that he'd probably rung about 30 or 40 other surfers before he got down to my name at the bottom of the barrel. And it was because where they wanted us to go and surf and the wave was absolutely terrifying. And no one wanted to go down and surf it. But for me, it was like, okay, if I say no to this, my career is done 100%. I'm never going to get this chance again. So I just said yes to it. And I ended up down in Tasmania surfing a wave called Shipstone's Bluff for the first time. And just because of a few different things, like I was on that day out in those waves, I was just more motivated than I'd ever been. One of the things was actually my mum was kind of pretty sick at the time, and she hadn't been able to work for probably 2 months straight, and I was living with her at the time, and we didn't know what was wrong with her. So in my head it was like from this point, like if she doesn't get better, I got to take care of her. And just having that in the back of my head when I went down to Tasmania was like, in that moment, it was that extra little bit of push that got me to swing around on a couple of waves that were huge. And then I wiped out on them, like the first ones that were the biggest waves, biggest, scariest waves that I'd surfed to date. I wiped out on the first two, but I came straight up without a scratch on me. And I was kind of like, hold on a minute, I can actually handle this. And then I went on to surf a bunch of massive waves that day. And from that one trip, the photos and the footage and everything went all around the world. And I got my first big surfing sponsorships because of that. And to me, it was like, oh, hold on a minute. This is how I can make money out of surfing. It's find the new huge big wave that everyone wants to see photos of people surfing. The magazines want it, the TV channels want it. And that can be my route to surfing. It was just then I had to figure out how to deal with all that anxiety and fear that went arm in arm with chasing massive waves around the world. Constantly thinking you're going to drown all the time and wiping out and the injuries and all that other stuff, and to be able to keep my career going. You know?
It's incredible, man, and it gives me goosebumps even thinking about it. But I think the one thing you said there was when you're talking about your mum and she was sick, and it was like you didn't have a choice, like you had to succeed. And I think that's something that really I respect about you, and knowing your story of growing up in Maroubra with your mates and pushing each other gradually, like, you know, to all these risk-taking behaviours that you did. It's like you got to a stage where you actually didn't have a choice but to succeed. And I suppose the question in that is like, how much growing up in Maroubra, in this surf community, hanging around with your mates that you had, actually helped you get to where you want to be?
Oh, it was massive. I mean, like, it's not like I didn't have a choice. I definitely had a choice, but it was just those different factors made me more motivated than I would have been. Like, you always kind of got a choice, but there was just enough there to push, that pushed me harder than what I'd been pushed before. And then growing up in Maroubra, I grew up with Kobe Abedin. Like, I followed him around. Like, little kid, he was 5 years older than me. He had a career as a professional surfer. Like, that's what made me really want it, because I just saw the lifestyle that he was living. Like, and when you're young, I was like 14, 15 years old, and he's driving around in the coolest, like, $100,000 car. He's got the hottest girlfriend. He's got all this money he can spend and travel and fly to Indonesia. I'm just like, I want that. I want that so bad. And he was one of the craziest big wave surfers on the planet. You know, like, he was still an amazing competitive surfer, because so he wasn't necessarily making career from big wave surfing at that point, but that he was so fearless in the ocean that just being around that helped me see what was possible out in the surf. Like, I started to eventually get to the point, like, I would train as hard as him, I would be as fit as him, I'd be as strong as him. And then, so in my head, I was like, well, if he's not dying on the waves that he's riding, then I can ride them too and not die, you know, like, and that was my mentality.
Just on the growing up in Maroubra, and I suppose around these guys like Kobe and one of your mates, Richie Vass, and there's so many others that we can talk about now, but like, what makes a surfing community like that so tribal? Like, you know, I grew up in the city and was always so envious of like beach towns and just like this community, this hub that it is, like, locals only. And watching Maroubra and hearing about these stories, like, that's what Maroubra was like. It was a community that was just so tight knit and really, like, stuck together and pushed each other.
Yeah, I think all beaches are like that. Like, surf spots, there's always, like, local surfers who surf that spot regularly, and they become a tribe, and you form bonds and friendships with them just based on your mutual love for surfing at a specific location. Like, that happens all around the world, like, everywhere. And then you have, like, board riders clubs. So you surf in a club and you compete against other beaches clubs. So even in that, you're competing together. So in a sense, you're also like a team. So it's like, there's that competitive nature. I think what Maroubra had that, like, other places have this, but it maybe had it more so than others, is it was like an inner city suburb, and there was a huge amount of, like, housing commission right on the beach at Maroubra. So it was real blue collar, like a sort of that lower class, an economically lower class a population of people. And so there was a huge generation of kids growing up in the housing commissions who had, like, pretty dog shit family lives, like junky parents, or like violent parents, or like they were growing up in shit environments. And I think that added to the sort of brotherhood of the surfing community, because those kids could escape what they were growing up in at home and all that shit at home. And then they would see, like, they didn't have the family at home. Like, they didn't even like their family, a lot of these kids. And so they saw, like, our friendships as their family. And I think that just creates a tighter bond, you know, between everyone down there. And that makes it really attractive to more kids coming from those type of homes, because they see that. And it's like, of course, if you're a young kid and you have dog shit parents, like, that treat you like shit, you would love to be part of something like that. Like, that's a family that you're missing out on, you know? And I think that's what made the bond really, really tight. But in saying that, if you take, you know, like, 100 young boys growing up in that environment with those shit parents, it's like, you're going to get some rough kids. Like, that's kind of, they don't survive those households without becoming, like, rough. And that's kind of where that sort of tough nature and that rough mentality probably came from within that surfing community at Maroubra. And I mean, there's good things that go with that and bad things. So, like, for me, it was amazing because it taught me to be tougher and stronger and braver and more courageous in the surf, you know, and that helped me to get a career from surfing. But when you take that mentality where it's like, fear is a weakness, and you should never back down from anything. Like in the surf, that's awesome. But you take that into the street as a young boy growing up in a inner city sort of suburban community where there's all that macho aggression on the street, that's a recipe for disaster, you know, and that's where all the sort of the trouble went hand in hand with it.
Well, that's the thing, man, as well, isn't it? Like, I think that's such an integral part of your story, and I've reflected on this in my own journey. Like, growing up, the mates that I hang around with, like, you are who you surround yourself with, and you pick up tendencies, you push each other, you do all these things, and if you're surrounding yourself with good people, you know, you do good things. And I think with your story especially, like, you've, you know, I'm not putting words in your mouth, but from my perspective, like, you've been successful because you've grown up with these people around you that you've just pushed each other and consistently pushed the boundaries. Like, your best mate, Richie Vass, he's a UFC fighter. You guys continually push each other to do the right thing and further your careers. But as you said as well, if you don't harness that and use it as just a positive, it also can become a negative off, you know, the sporting arena as well and in your life.
Oh, 100%. It completely polarizes. It's like when you take that kind of drive and affinity for doing fearless things and you channel it positively, like, that can change kids' lives, like, massively. Like, if you teach a kid who's come from a shit home and just, like, life sucks, if you're like, and they're, like, poor as shit compared to everyone else around them, but if you teach them that they have this friendship group, that they should be proud of who they are, where they're from, that they shouldn't back down in the face of anything, that they should strive hard to break a barrier. Like, that all sounds like a fucking Anthony Robbins talk, right? Like, that's exactly what you should be teaching a kid, but it has to be in the right context, you know? And it just, like, kind of spilled over in different, like, periods of time into bad context, you know? Like, so if you put that context into chasing a career or growing a business, like, you can see transitions of guys that I grew up with that started a trade, worked hard in a trade, like, come from the shit family, started a trade, worked hard in the trade, and now have their own business, and they're multimillionaires because of that, like, mental framework applied to hard work, you know? Yeah. But then you apply that to sport, and then you've got all, like, these sporting successes, like John Sutton, he's, like, the captain of the Bunnies. You got Rennie Matua, who played for Australia in rugby league. Like, you've got all these amazing sports successes as well. But then when you apply that mentality to the vices that teenagers pick up, whether it's violence on the street, whether it's drugs, like, you apply a fearless attitude to taking drugs, like, it's just like it doesn't get any worse than that. So it's kind of like, but that's what happened. Like, it's never going to be 100% positive, and it kind of just fractures. Like, you see the amazingly good things about it, and then the amazingly bad things about it. And I was just lucky in a lot of situations that I got away with making a lot of bad mistakes when I was young, and realized that, like, if I keep doing this, I'm one way. It's either I'm going to die or go to jail. That, like, that's the road if I go that way. And then this is the road if I go the other way. But a lot of, like, and it was luck in a lot of moments, you know, whereas a lot of other young guys aren't lucky in those moments.
Yeah. Oh, mate, it's terribly frightening. And I think you summed it up incredibly. Like, our biggest strengths are also our biggest weaknesses. Like, what makes you tick and what makes you the best you are is also your downfall and can catch you up, but it's identifying where to put your energy. Exactly like you said, I've had to realize it the hard way, probably not as an extreme level, but, like, it's not what happens, it's how we react to it, I suppose. And what happened to you in those situations, you use that as a positive. And as you said, you get that opportunity to go to Shipsterns, things start following your way, you make the choice, even though, as you said, you did have other choices, but you make that choice to start investing, going hard at a surfing career. What transpires from this? Like, after that first time when you actually start realizing, fuck, this can actually be my career, a big wave surfer, how do you then take the next step to making it a consistent thing?
It's all about, for me, I was never a super talented surfer. So it was like, on one hand, I had to learn how to manage the fear and the stress and the anxiety to be able to motivate myself to surf the big waves, surf them consistently, and then to pick up any sort of lack of talent where there were better surfers out there. I had to learn the business aspect of being a professional surfer and why companies want to give me money. Like, why would they give me money? And so I just made it a point to be savvy within the surfing industry and the business aspect of it and learn everything about it so that I'm more valuable to a company than another more talented surfer might be. So I had to learn all of that stuff. And all those two different things, like being able to manage the fear, helped me sort of sustain motivation across a long period. But then learning all the other skills outside of actually riding a wave within the business, that made me more sort of valuable to sponsors across a longer period. And I think like it's those combination of those two things that helped me get a career when the reality is, like, based on my talent, I probably didn't deserve the career that I had, you know, like, not even close. There was so many other better surfers out there than me that could have done what I did easy.
Well, we always like to say it through this show, but you're not a businessman, you are a business man.
Yeah,
and exactly. That's the show that we like to say, because how does that actually transpire? Like, you are a surfer, like, because like I've played football, you sort of work out elite sport, you go, you get paid, but it's not like that in surfing. Like, from my understanding, is it you have to like fund your own trips, you have to get a cameraman to come with you, source these waves, get all the content available, then take that to sponsors and say, hey, this is what I did, can you sponsor me? Like, it's a real hustle. Like, you've actually got to like put in the work, invest money, invest time, and hopefully it works out to be able to make a living off it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's kind of the model, but there's different variations of how it plays out. If you sign with a certain big company like a Billabong or a Rip Curl, you sign the contract with them and then they do all that for you. They just say, we want you to go here, here and here, and we're going to do everything else to promote you, you know? But when you do that, it's like your destiny is then in their hands, you know? And if they then see another young kid coming up, then they push you to the side and they use that person, you know? And you have way less control with what, you know, with the profile that's being created. They might say to you, we're going to sign you up, but we're only going to use you in, we're not going to pay you to go to this big swell or this big swell or this big swell, because we just want you on this one. That's what fits our program and the amount of money we want to pay you. So I always just wanted to do everything myself and then just show the value to the company and get paid the money off the sponsors, but I'll take care of the rest. So I had way more control in what I was going to be doing throughout a year, because I knew that it was all based on your profile, right? And your ability to create content which markets your sponsor's product, you know? And so I knew that I wanted to be on every single big swell. And so I would go into debt, you know, some years where I wasn't getting paid all that much from sponsors to be at every swell, to have all the cameras there, to be creating the profile, getting the footage, getting the content, going out into the media, and I'd invest like an extra, you know, 30 grand that I didn't have. So I'd be down 30 or 50 grand for the year, but then that would pay, that I would get that back on the next sponsorship deal the following year or the year after. So it was just a constant investment in building the profile that made you marketable for companies.
And was there a time when that didn't have to happen? Was there a time when after all that investment, all that work you put in, like you signed with O'Neill, after that, was there a time where you were like, sweet, I'm just a pro surfer now, I can do it, a pro big wave surfer now, I can do whatever I want? Or because you'd used that mindset and that hustle mindset to get to where you needed to be, it's like you just didn't change it and you just kept doing the same thing.
Yeah, I hit a period when I was around sort of late 20s, early 30s, yeah, coming into mid 30s, where I was kind of like finally earning good amount of money where I could save some money, you know, like, so I could have like sat back and rested there and you know, taking the foot off the pedal and saved my money and just did what I was doing. But in my head, I was like, I was never earning the type of money where I wouldn't have to work after surfing, like not even close, like not even in that ballpark. So I always knew that it was never going to last forever. And my contracts were only ever a year, 2 years, max sort of 3 years long. So I was always thinking about the next sponsorship after this contract was gone, or the next, you know, negotiation based on this sponsor. And so I was just constantly always thinking about that. And I was always imagining the day where I wasn't going to get paid for surfing and what I was going to do. And then that led me down the path of professional speaking and keynote speaking. And it was valuable to, because I learned that 10 years ago I started to do that. So for 10 years while I was still surfing professionally, I was doing that on the side. And then I realized the value of like learning the skills of communication and then how valuable that is in the surfing world, you know, as well. So they both kind of went hand in hand there.
That's huge, man. Hey, let's talk about one of, you know, a really big, I suppose, crucible moment in your life, which was at Shipsterns. We were mentioning it earlier, but this wave, for people that don't know it, off the coast of Tasmania, one of the scariest waves I've ever seen. Like, it's got somehow like a double lip. Like, how does that even happen? Do we know like the science around that? Like, why is that wave so disformed?
What makes it real spectacular and what makes most waves spectacular is when it comes out of really deep water and then breaks onto a really shallow reef. And then I think why Shipstones is extra spectacular is that the reef that it's breaking it on is so uneven that when the water pulls out towards the wave, it's like it's hitting this uneven bottom and then making like these rapids, like kind of like water, like river rapids in the wave as it's breaking. And that's what makes it like this, like turn into this sort of mutated, spectacular looking beast of a wave, which, I mean, it's fun to ride when you make it. Sucks when you wipe out, but in what I do, the more spectacular looking the wave is, the better the content is and the more valuable the content is.
Well, mate, let's go back to that, you know, really big day that probably changed a lot of things for you in your journey of surfing at Shipsterns, if you're happy to talk about it. There was a big day out there where you went out with a couple of friends and from more reports as well, I think it was Steve Irwin's, one of the anniversary of Steve Irwin's passings. You went out there to celebrate with a couple of mates and had a pretty big stack out there that sort of changed, I suppose, your perspective of surfing and the course of your career at that stage.
Yeah, the day, I think it was 2006 or 7 when I was surfing Shipstones and I had the first really scary wipeout that I'd had up until that point. Like I've had different moments in my career that kind of sort of remind me that how dangerous what I'm doing is and how dangerous it is to become overconfident in the ocean. We were at Shipstones and it was massive, like 20 foot plus. And it just so happened that Steve Irwin had passed away in the weeks lead up to that. And we thought it'd be cool to pay tribute to him and ride a couple of massive waves because he was a passionate surfer, but holding on to a big blow up crocodile. And I was down there with Richie and some of the photos of that turned out so amazing and it was awesome and it was all successful on that front. But then I tried to capture some point of view footage of this kind of before GoPros were created. And I had a camera strapped to my waist, the body of a camera, and then the lens of the camera strapped to a helmet on my head that had the lens so we could capture what it looked like to get barreled at Shipstones. And I just picked a bad wave, wiped out, and got smashed into the reef. And I got knocked unconscious just for a moment underwater. And I remember like this real clear recollection of waking up but not knowing what was going on and just being in this really cold, dark place and just having no idea what was going on just for a moment of time. And then I kind of broke the surface of the water as I was coming up and saw the big cliff of Shipstones Bluff. And then I realized like where I was and what was happening. And then this pain just set in down my neck, down my spine and pins and needles down into my arms. And I was just like, oh no, what have I done? Richie and the boys came in and rescued me and pulled me up onto the boat. And I was just screaming in pain because my neck was so sore. And I was sure I'd broken my neck. Not to the point where I was paralyzed because I could move everything, but the nerve pain was so bad. And so they like braced me on the boat and put like wrapped towels and stuff around my neck so nothing would move. Just that everyone was terrified that, you know, as we were going back in the boat over these 20-foot swells, that would bounce and then that would like end up doing something to my spinal cord, you know, like, so it was so scary, this like 2-hour ride back to land. Anyway, eventually I got back to land, went in an ambulance to the hospital, and it probably took about 8 hours before I got x-ray results back of what was going on. And I remember being so nervous. I thought my career was finished. I think it was around that time when Andrew Johns, a rugby league player, had a neck injury that kind of stopped his career. And I had that in the back of my head that was going to be me. Like, I was going to be fine to walk around, but the doctor was about to walk in and tell me that you can't surf again because if you wipe out, you'll become a quadriplegic. And I thought for sure, I spent like 8 hours on the way to the hospital and getting the results, just thinking that that's what was going to happen. And then the doctor walks in, x-ray results in his hand, looks up at me and he's just like, "Mate, you are one lucky bastard." He said, "There's no serious spinal cord damage. Like, you've compressed, your spine's compressed on the nerves. That's why you got so much pain."
Fuck.
But he's like, "You're going to recover. No troubles. Like, within a month's time, you'll be back to normal." He goes, you'll probably be back down here for the next big swell at Shipstone surfing again." I was like, I wasn't down there for the next swell or the one after that or the one after that. I mean, my neck recovered quick. Like, physically, I was fine, just like he said, within a month, 6 weeks, and I was surfing again. But mentally, whoa, it was a whole nother story. Like, I was so rattled by what happened that I was just, like, terrified to go out and surf big waves again. And it took me probably, I don't know, a year or 18 months to get back to being full confident. And, yeah, that was a tough journey.
Even on that though, Mark, like, is it true that you actually randomly that session had a helmet on just for that wave?
Yeah, the only reason, it's the first time I've ever worn a helmet, and it was because the lens of the camera that we were using that was strapped to my body, like, so the big body of the camera was strapped to my waist and then the lens was stuck to the helmet. And that's the only reason I've ever worn a helmet. And there was a massive hole, like 10 centimeter diameter sort of hole in the helmet where I'd hit the reef. So if I had to hit the reef without the helmet, my skull would probably have that bigger hole in it. In saying that, kind of the helmet made me wipe out a bit. Like, it was just so awkward to surf in it. And I had the camera on. So if I wasn't doing that, I probably wouldn't have wiped out on the wave.
Yeah, there's two ways of looking at it. Speaking of that mental journey, I suppose, then getting back to the top of your game, I can't imagine how tough that would have been. For one, being a big wave surfer, scary enough. Two, having a wipeout like that. What were some of these demons like? Was it something that you could actually get back in the water, or was it more like you were just, when you were taking off on a wave, was it like nightmares? Was it just self-doubt? Like, what sort of things were you sort of going through at that stage to actually overcome and get back in the water?
The main situation that was giving me so much trouble, like, I would be back surfing fine and I'd be training and I'd be the fittest I've been, like, doing all the preparation stuff for the next big swell. But then as soon as I would go online, like, I go online every morning and check the swell forecast to see what's happening around the world. And as soon as I would check the swell forecast on any given morning and see that I was going to be surfing massive waves again in a week's time, like, from that moment, like, the reality that I was headed back to big waves, like, that would just trigger the anxiety. And it was like, then in that whole next week, I just have a constant stream of thoughts in my head about all the things that were going to go wrong in a week's time when I surfed. And I'd just play all these wipeouts through my head. And then at night, I'd be dreaming about, I'd be waking up in the middle of the night, like, in cold sweats, thinking I was, like, stuck in a wheelchair because I just wasn't lucky this time. And it would just, like, play nonstop. And then, like, I didn't want to lose my career, so I kind of had to go to these swells. But by the time I turn up on the day of the swell to surf, I was physically exhausted. Like more often than not, I would actually have the flu-like symptoms. Like I'd have aches and pains. I'd have like either like sore throat or like just like I had the flu. Like I was full on sick on the day that I would have to surf. And I realized that that was happening because of that mental stress and anxiety that I was having for an entire week lead up before I'd surf. So I'd go through so many wipeouts in my head that by the time I got to surf, it was like my body had been through the wipeouts physically before I'd even put a foot in the water. So I'm absolutely exhausted just from thinking all these things. And it was actually one of the best lessons for me in dealing with sort of stress and fear was how powerful like those thoughts are in your head. And everyone has them. Like you mentally forecast what could possibly go wrong so that you can adjust what you're doing and not die. Like that's just a survival mechanism in your brain. And I realized how valuable it was then because it got to a point where I just couldn't turn up on the day and surf or actually perform. Like I could still surf, but I wouldn't have enough energy to go out and put on a good performance. So I went to see a guy called Naam Baldwin, who's a personal trainer, coach, trains like a lot of the top surfers, trains Olympic athletes. Like he's a freak trainer. He has a background in free diving. And he showed me when I went to see him exactly like the effect those thoughts were having on me. So he plugged me into like a heart rate variability monitor. And then he would get me to imagine wiping out or replay the wipeouts that I'd had in my head. And then he'd show me what that was doing to my heart, which is a pretty good representation of your nervous system, you know? And then he would just give me all these different techniques to basically break the connection from the anxious thoughts and their effect on your physical body. So it's like there's all these different mental hacks and techniques to just sever that connection so your body's not having a physical response. Like so you think the thought, you dwell on it for too long, it creates an emotional response, and the emotional response your body's having is taxing on you physically, right? So he gave me just all these simple techniques to just break that. And I mean, that's what now when people mention mindfulness techniques or meditation, that's basically what you're doing. You're bringing yourself into the present moment so you're not dwelling on the thoughts, negative thoughts about the future or the past. And one technique that was really valuable was one called The Work. It was from a book written by an author named Byron Katie. I can't remember the name of the book, but if you Google online, it's called The Work. And she has a website that kind of takes you through the process, and it's so valuable. And what it would do was, it was just a process where you would question the thoughts and the validity of those thoughts. And by doing it, it would break that connection. So, and there's like four questions. I would always stop and I'd always write them down. I found it way more powerful to write it down rather than try and do it in your head, because you kind of can't beat your brain and how scared your brain gets. Like it justifies your fears at the speed of light. Like that's why it's real good to write things down, like get it out of your head. And I would just answer these questions like, what is the thought that you're having? So I'd write a real descriptive thing about the thoughts that I was having. And then it was like, is that thought true? Like, and it's like, well, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I could turn up on the day to surf and the weather conditions could be wrong. So I might not even end up surfing. So it's not necessarily that thought's even true, like whether it's going to definitely happen or not. So you're like, no, this thought's not real or it's not true. Like I can't be sure. And then it's like, when you think the thought, how does it make you feel? So I just play the thought out in my head and then I feel the tension. Like you feel like when you have those anxious thoughts, you can, the emotional response, you can tell the tension in your body. It's like your shoulders lift, you know? Like everyone gets sore neck when they're nervous or been stressed out because you're constantly lifting up your shoulders into your ears all the time. You can feel your heart rate elevate a little bit. You can see different things like tension in your body. You might grip your hands. You might grip your toes into the ground. Like you might furrow your brow. Like there's all these different tension responses based on the way you're thinking. And so I would notice all these and I'd write them all down. So this is how it's making me feel, making me anxious, nervous. I can notice that I'd feel all this tension. And then it's like the last question, which is where it's kind of all the powerful part of it. It's like, okay, so let go of the thought. And without that thought, so stop thinking about it for a moment. How do you feel if you don't think about it? And it's like as soon as you do that, your whole body relaxes. Like it's just like, oh, like a full on relaxation moment because you were just dwelling on the thought and then you purposely let go of it. And it's just the confidence just creeps back into your body and the energy creeps back into your body. And that sort of like, it's like all that tension just evaporates. And that's where you just like, I did that over and over and over and over again. Like I had workbooks full of the times I was writing that shit out in my head just to constantly break the connection over and over again. Because, I mean, it comes straight back like within sort of an hour's time you start thinking about it again, but then exactly. You got to do it again. But the more I did it, the less I'd have the thoughts, you know, or the less, not even the less I'd have the thoughts, but it was like the less powerful the effect was that those thoughts had on me. And then I started to turn up on the day of swells just with a little bit more energy each time. Like, and when I had more energy, I'd have more confidence and I'd surf better. And then I just built it up like across 18 months and I just felt better and better and better and better. And that was like one of the kind of mental hack ways of managing that anxiety that went along with surfing big waves. And it's just like, learning that because of that wipeout helped me heaps, because before I had that wipeout, I still had the stress and the anxiety, like the nerves of going to surf big waves, but I'd just keep pushing through it. I'd just push through. But that just wore me down. Like it was too taxing and it didn't need to be as taxing as it was. It was like you're creating 100 extra wipeouts every day that you don't need to be going through, you know, like that's what anxiety's doing to you or what stress is doing to you. So yeah, that was a big learning curve for me. It helped me perform after that way better, like just because I had more energy after that.
I absolutely love that, man. I've literally just like written that down, like challenge your thoughts, ask if it's true, how does it make you feel, who would you be without that thought is like, so, like I even felt like relaxed even thinking about that. But I think the gold.
Yeah, and people can do it. Like just Google The Work. The Work, I'm pretty sure that website's still there. It was 10 years ago that I saw it, but it gets you to do it. And like the best example, everyday example that I sometimes mention to people is when you have, like say you're having an argument with your partner, right? And so say you've kind of like, you might've done something wrong. Like you might be running late or you've forgotten to pick up the shopping and you're driving home. And the whole way you're driving home, like, so say for half an hour, you're driving home in traffic, you're imagining your partner's response to what's going on. And you're just imagining them getting angry and furious at you and like the conflict that you're going to have when you walk in the door and the excuses that you're going to need to give. And that whole drive home, you're like anxious and tense, right? And then who knows, you might walk in the door and your partner just won 10 grand on a lottery ticket and they don't give a shit that you didn't pick up the shopping, you know, it's not necessarily real, the thoughts in your head, but they're having a real effect because you're forecasting what might happen. And if the thoughts about what might happen aren't going to change your actions in the moment, then they're useless. You know, like those negative thoughts are valuable if they force you to prepare more or to take a different course of action. But if they're just there and you're not doing anything different, then they're basically useless.
It comes back to that, like, emotion versus logic is basically is what we're explaining, I think, now. Like, emotion versus logic, take that time to analyze the situation and actually think logically about it. And as you said, that's what anxiety does. It's emotional. It makes you react on things, like, straight away. I think the real goal, though, like, from that I really picked up on from what you said that has been massive for me is, like, you know, we all have these situations. We all know what it's like to have anxiety, have fear of something. But the one thing I know I need to get better at personally is, like, creating that trigger as a habit. Like you said then, it's like you don't do this, you don't challenge your thoughts once and, like, it just creates it and becomes normal again. You've got to challenge it 10, 20, 30, 100, 200, 500 times. Like you said, you had 4 books worth of things that make you to get to that stage. It's like an 18-month journey. It's like training your brain to get out of that habit and get back into the habit of rationalizing your thoughts a bit more. And I suppose, like, that was a goal that I got out of it from your point of view. It's like, fuck, I go, yeah, but I do this, but I don't trigger it consistently enough to make it a habit so that I don't have those thoughts anymore.
Yeah, well, that's why writing it down so good. So at the end of the day or at the end of the week, you can't hide. It's like, did you do it or didn't you do it? You can see if you wrote it down. Like, you can imagine you're doing it in your head, but I guarantee it's nowhere near as effective. I came across a really good technique just a few years ago to that exact point that you're making, like, to get yourself to do these different changes and form these different habits. And I can't remember where I came across it, but it's called habit stacking. And it's where you take, like, the new positive lifestyle habits that you want to implement and you stack them on top of your primary habits. So your primary habits are like all the different things that you do every day. Like, you might wake up every morning, have a coffee, shower, brush your teeth, commute to work, have lunch, like all these things that you do day in, day out, all the time, no matter what, like they're built into you. They're your habitual patterns, your primary habits. So you just take the positive lifestyle habit. So what we've been discussing is doing the work or questioning a negative thought that you might be having. So you take that technique and you piggyback it on top of what you're doing already. So it's like, you don't allow yourself to have a coffee tomorrow morning without writing down or questioning a negative thought that you might have in your head. So when you're drinking the coffee, you're writing it down and it's like you piggyback it on top of it. So you don't have to create new energy or new amount of time to implement a positive lifestyle habit that you want to implement it. You just use the time that you already have, like in those moments. And then it kind of, then it becomes habitual in that it's like you'll, you know, a year down the track be sitting down drinking your coffee and your brain will just, like, you won't even need to do the writing. Your brain will just, like, shift and, like, let go of some anxiety just because you've, like, trained it in those moments to do that.
I love that.
Yeah, that's a pretty good technique. I come across that a few years ago.
Oh, mate, we could talk about this all day, I think, even off air. But, like, there's one that for me has, like, so badly, it's nearly an OCD that I've picked up on. Like, I used to be really bad at, like, negative talk. So I'd be like, I'm not there. Like, I can't do this. I'll never do that. Fuck this, fuck that. But I got in this habit of just, like, changing the words. Like, I'm not there yet. I'll be doing that soon. You know, like, all those things that instead of saying I'm not doing it, it's like you positively spin it. And now even when I'm talking to people and they say something, I, like, correct it for them, but, like, not to them, but, like, in my head, I'd, like, I wouldn't say it like that. I'd say it like this. But you're right. It's all about that just habitual stuff that you can just consistently keep doing. Because, man, it's evident that it worked for you because after this, you learn how to challenge your thoughts. I suppose the surfing took care of itself and that's when you start doing some of the biggest things. I think you went from being dropped from all your sponsors to then being signing a 3-year deal with a new sponsor later that year.
Yeah, it was like 18 months later that I won my first Oakley Big Wave Award and then went on it to win like 3 consecutive years. And off the back of that, I got all my biggest surfing sponsorships. And I, like, it wasn't just that, but it was like, it was an ability to manage your energy. Like, that's what that technique's doing. It's giving you energy back because you're not wasting it on thoughts that are unnecessary, you know? And like I said before, it's like the clear distinction is that the thoughts are survival, is a survival mechanism, those negative thoughts. And if they're going to prompt you to take different action, they're valuable. Like, because I'll still do it. It's like, if I think about I'm going back down to ship zones, I'm going to surf huge waves, and I'm starting to have some of these negative thoughts, they may be because I'm not prepared properly and my team's not prepared for the swell we're about to go and surf. So I have to take the preparation. Otherwise, it's in the hacks and doing the work and writing them down. It won't stand a chance. Like, you got to do the preparation. Like, you know this from playing footy. It's like you can like try all the different like hacks possible, but if you're not prepared, if you're not fit, if your team hasn't been training well, it's like, then it's not going to work, you know? Like, so I can think about, you know, wiping out, blacking out underwater and how terrifying that's going to be. So then I've got to do the preparation that thought is prompting me to do. So it's like, all right, I'm doing all the underwater training. I'm fit. I'm healthy. I'm working with my team, and we're going to formulate a plan for when that happens, or if it happens, exactly what we're going to do. So it's like, this is where, like, when you pick me up and I'm unconscious, this is the boat that you're going to take me for. This is where the defibrillator is going to be if you need to bring me back. Like, this is how long the helicopter takes to get there. This is where they can pick me up from. This is how long it'll take to get to the hospital. Like, and when you formulate those plans based on the negative thoughts, then it settles the negative thoughts down. And then whatever's left over with the negative thoughts, then you use the techniques, like the mental hack techniques, the mindfulness techniques, the work, like we were just talking about. Like, but like, I, to make the distinction that you have to do the preparation, that's like, I feel like I have to mention that, because often people are like, don't want to do the preparation because the preparation's hard, man. Yeah. So that, because you got to then think about the shit that can go wrong and don't take the head in the sand approach and do that work, you know? And, but so the hacks, the preparation's the foundation. The hacks are like the decoration, you know? Yeah.
I love that. That's when you say there around the fear of the fear and the anxiety comes from uncertainty, but like, yes, by making things certain and by putting these things in place, like if I'd fucking rocked up today and not known anything I was going to talk about, I'd feel like absolute shit. But because I've fucking done my research, like I know what I want to talk to you about, like I feel just comfortable, and then we just have a chat. It can really be related to anything. It's not just big surfing, I suppose. And that's the way I was trying, you know, like talking to big, you know, people like yourself, you can get nervous, but if you know you've put in the work to do it, I feel better about it.
That's what you're saying is exactly it. Like, all fear is uncertainty. Like, it's all of it is. Every fear that you have is to do with uncertainty. It's like, you don't know whether you're going to be successful or fail, or whether people are going to like you or not like you. Like, you're going to live or you're going to die, or you know, like, it's all uncertainty. So where you can build certainty in your life is how you unlift or lift anxiety. Like, so it's, yeah, there's no more important thing than that. But then everything else, like all those different, like, I feel like there's an entire industry built around, like, and you would know it, like the performance coaches and all the mindfulness industry and all these different things. They're so valuable, but they're like 10% compared to 90%,
yep,
of what preparation is.
And I also feel like a lot of the time, like you've said then, we, like in sporting environments, in professional environments, you focus on like what to do when shit hits the fan. But like a lot of stuff isn't focused on like getting yourself right so you don't hit the fan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You said that then, I suppose, like a big thing about you, and something that being a big wave surfer is like something that I'm so fascinated about. Because I think surfing like has this connotation where people wouldn't understand it. You'd think people just rock up, they sleep in, they go surf, and that's just all they do. But like the fitness and the training that would go behind big wave surfing, I'm talking hypoxic sessions, like underwater, like being able to, you know, what's it, like level your ears and what's that called when you're like leveling your sinuses like underground, underwater. How much training goes into that? Like what sort of training are you doing? And even to give some insight, like if you're happy to, like how long like do you try and stay underwater for? Like what are you thinking about when you're underwater? How do you stay calm? Because like I've nearly fucking drowned before, man, and I was probably underwater for 3 seconds, you know?
Yeah. And that's the same for everyone. But it's like I need like the strength and fitness is one aspect. So I've got to stay fit, I've got to stay healthy, and I've got to be strong. Like, so that's all your standard gym training. the underwater training is like you've got to go through just this one period to retrain your brain, your brain's panic response to running out of oxygen. And you just do that by being down there over and over again and learning all the different sensations that your body goes through as it runs out of oxygen. Because often you'll panic when you're underwater or when you're holding your breath at about a third of the way into your capacity. Like you'll feel pain in your chest and your brain will freak out and be like, I got to get out of here, I'm going to die, because that pain represents running out of oxygen. But what the freedivers tell you is that, and what they teach you is that pain in your chest is not necessary that you're running out of oxygen, is that carbon dioxide's building up in your lungs. So you actually still have a lot of oxygen in there, but the carbon dioxide is creating the pain. But it's like when you know that, it's like you can deal with that pain better. That's what breath hold is about, dealing with pain. Like free divers, it's all their ability to deal with the pain of the carbon dioxide buildup. And so you got to kind of go through a training program that teaches you that. And then just straight away, like a good freediver taking you on a, like Narm Baldwin, if anyone wants to do a breath hold course, he does them all around the country. If you go and train with him, he'll get you from, if your breath holds like a minute underwater, he'd get you to 3 minutes in one go by taking you through the steps, teaching you the knowledge, and then drilling you through the skills and the preparation. So it's like, it's learning that so that, and then doing it over and over again so that you don't freak out every time you feel that pain from the carbon dioxide. And that's just, then you control that panic response. So then now that I've done that, I don't necessarily need to do that all the time because I've taught myself that. But now it's just about staying healthy and being fit, like aerobically fit enough, and then and strong so the injuries don't come.
Is there something specific though, like when you're underwater, you try and think about? Because I know, when, you know, the more you move, the more you panic, the more air you're actually using of yourself. So is it literally just like rolling into a ball and just going to your happy place? Like, do you try and picture anything in particular? Is there something that you can sort of like escape and just go like, all right, fuck, I'm going to be here for a minute, 2 minutes? Like what's even the longest you've been underwater and had to feel the way you have?
Yeah, it depends a lot on what safety equipment you have. Like if you have an inflatable vest on or something that's buoyant that's going to bring you to the surface after a wipeout, then it's all about, it's like kind of switching off and relaxing and not fighting. Because when you fight, especially when you kick your legs, your legs use up a lot of oxygen. So it's like it's maintaining relaxed, don't fight, don't panic, and just allow the vest to bring you to the top. Use your arms a little bit if you need. But when you don't have inflation stuff on, you have to be a lot more alert. So when I wipe out, I feel like it happens now naturally for me. So it's like if a wipeout's bad and it's a huge wave and I know it's bad, it's like right on the moment I'm about to panic, it's like my brain's trained to just relax because it knows that that's the only way I'm going to survive. And the situation forces it to relax in a way because I've done the training beforehand. Sometimes I'll use like a trigger where I'll like force myself to smile a little bit underwater and kind of relax myself. I know that other surfers like will play out like in their mind, a different environment. I think Ross Clark Jones, one of the best big wave surfers in the world, he, while he's getting rolled around underwater, would imagine being in a nightclub and having a hell fun time. Like that's what he did, you know, like to take him away from the fear. But I think my brain now kind of just, if it's a bad enough wipeout, it will naturally just shift into a relaxed mode because it knows that that's the only way I can survive. But then I have to stay alert enough to know where I am underwater and whether or not the reef's close, if I'm going to hit the reef, which way is up or down. And you slightly moving underwater to get away from the, what would you call them, like the power pockets that drive you down deeper. Like you want to just move across from them, and that's all like, it's kind of like you got your eyes shut most of the time and you're just feeling where they're pulling you and you're just going against them and working your way to the surface. But it's it's just different if you've got safety gear on and off. But that's where the safety takes it. You know, like being prepared and having enough the safety equipment on, having people that you trust on the jet skis looking out for you, that helps you deal with a wipeout more than anything else.
Mate, to finish up, couple tidbits. I'd love to know your favourite wave to surf, favourite place, and the scariest wave to surf. Well, I think we might know the answer to that one already.
I think they're the same. At the moment, I go in and out of different waves. Like, I was fascinated with Jaws that breaks off Maui, or Piahi is the local name. That's probably the biggest barreling wave on planet Earth, and it's the pinnacle of especially big wave paddle surfing. And I was a fascination with that for a good 5, 6, 7 years, like trying to figure it out every season in Hawaii. And across the majority of my career, Shipstone's Bluff on the southeast corner of Tasmania has probably been, it's the wave that gave me my career, like kickstarted my career. It's a wave that I almost died at when I hit the reef, and it's just a wave that I've fallen in love with, and it's, I love it, but it's also one of the scarier waves on the planet.
For me, not that I've surfed in any of them, but one wave that actually scares the fuck out of me. As a kid, I watched the movie Billabong Odyssey like a lot, and I think there's obviously Jaws, which is, as you're saying, is off Maui, but is there another one called Mavericks or that's in the middle of the ocean?
Toto Santos, it's called. So that breaks like, I don't know how many miles, like you can't see land.
So that's the scary thing for me, is more like with the ones that, I know they're probably even more dangerous because they're on reef, but the ones that are out in the middle of the ocean, like that, is there another fear factor there where you just go like, fuck, I am literally in the middle of the ocean right now. We're quite far away from land for one, but two, I feel like deep sea ocean, like who knows what's around, like where you are.
Mate, those sharks swim into waist-deep water, so yeah. It don't matter how far you're out.
Okay, that's fantastic.
But yeah, like there's a lot of locations that I'm terrified of sharks at. Your proximity to help and a hospital is also another one that's scary. For me, just after the last injury I had where I destroyed my knee hitting a reef, now at the moment surfing shallow waves with rock beds is the scariest thing for me to do at the moment. The safety equipment, the advances in the safety equipment and the inflatable vests that we can wear now, that takes out a lot of the fear in open ocean waves that where the danger is drowning. Like now that you have the vests on, you're pretty comfortable in huge open ocean waves, but hitting the reef to me now is the scariest.
What's next for Mark Matthews in the next phase of your life, mate?
Career-wise... I have more of a focus on public speaking now and sharing what I've learned about managing fear and stress and anxiety in the ocean with people in the corporate world or business owners or entrepreneurs. Like that's kind of my career now. I still surf and I still get paid to surf a bit, but my main focus is that. On the surfing front, the next big thing I'll be doing is competing in the Red Bull Cape Fear event back down at Shipstone's Bluff. We're currently in a waiting period now. So at any moment, we'll get a forecast that looks good enough. The conditions are going to be right. And we'll get 3 or 4 days notice to travel to Shipstones. And then it's kind of the country's best big wave surfers all compete down there in a big swell. So that one's keeping me training a little bit at the moment. So that's career surfing. And then I've got a 2-year-old daughter who's my first kid. So she takes up the majority of what time is left over.
Mark, mate, it's been absolutely unbelievable to have a chat with you. As I said, man, it's been a bucket list chat that I've had for a long time. Did not disappoint. Not only was it like an incredible story, but I just learned so much about, like you said, the fear and anxiety, managing uncertainty, being able to put those triggers in place. And I think, as you said, and you said it so perfectly, like making it habitual. It's not something that can be done once. It has to be done many, many times. So then be able to overcome your biggest fears. So you've lived it, you've breathed it, my friend, and yeah, it's a real honor to have you on the show.
Thanks a lot, Dill, man. It's been a pleasure chatting to you. If anyone wants to hear the rest of my story from the ship's turns point onward, Red Bull just released a new documentary. It's called The Other Side of Fear. It's free, it's online. If you Google Mark Matthews and The Other Side of Fear, it tells the whole story of what I've gone through more recently over the last 4 or 5 years.
Mark, mate, that is absolutely unbelievable. I couldn't top it. It's been real. It's been good. It's been bloody incredible. Cannot thank you enough for your time again, my friend. And hopefully we can catch up soon in the future for a few cold ones. I know you're a busy man, but I've always got time.
That'd be awesome, mate. I'll let you know when I'm down in your neck of the woods again.
Easy, bro.
We'll catch up for sure.
Thanks, mate. If that wasn't enough for you and you want even more, you're in luck. Dylan Friends is now on Patreon. Dylan Best Friends. An exclusive loyalty subscription featuring the debrief podcast of each episode and bonus Q&As from Patreon members like this. Is there a motto that you love? Like, we love our quotes, we love our mottos. Is there something that you like to use that sort of sums up your outlook on life or something that's been sort of close to your heart?
I say in all my talks, you got to want it more than you fear it. I think, like, what lies at the base of your ability to get through fear and reach your potential at whatever you want to do, like any aspect of life, whether it's to do with your career, your business, your personal life, your relationships, your health. Like, you've got to want what's on the other side of all those fears and apprehensions that are holding you back. You got to want that more than you fear it. So it's like a question of motivation. So figure out how to motivate yourself, because often that road's tough. So figuring out how to motivate yourself is a good one.
And there's plenty more where that came from. If you'd like to learn more, you can head to patreon.com/Dylan Friends, or you can head to the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening to the Dylan Friends podcast. If you liked the show, it'd be a massive help if you could like, follow, rate, leave a review, or even share with your friends. The show is produced by myself and Sam Bonza. Damon Jackman from Creative Edge Films is responsible for audio and visual production. The show is recorded at the Dylan Friends Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you'd like to get in touch or suggest a guest or advertise with the Dylan Friends podcast, please email us at inquiries@dylanfriends.com. Thanks so much for tuning in.